Super Bowl 52 is set, how Brady did it again without Gronk, and how it went wrong for the Jaguars. On the NFC side, Nick Foles does his best Carson Wentz impression as Philly takes the NFC. We'll preview Patriots-Eagles and talk Blake Bortles' future, what the Vikings are doing at quarterback, and the latest coaching hires, all of it on the MMQB 10 Things podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit, and we have Super Bowl 52 participants set. It's all very exciting. It's the Patriots and the Eagles, which I guess if you work at the NFL and you're worried about the buzz around this game, I guess this was your best case scenario at this point, right?
Yeah, it feels right. I like it when you get two number one seeds in the Super Bowl, and I know people within the NFL appreciate that too. I like the validation of the regular season.
I'll give you that. I mean, I like when you get some of the like this Jaguars team. This Jaguars team is going to stick around for a little while. We'll talk about their offseason look ahead later in the show, but they're going to be around for a while. I thought it would have been nice to introduce them to America in a big way, since everyone should really know about them, and I'm not sure how many people do. They weren't on TV a whole lot.
At this point, isn't getting defeated by Tom Brady down the stretch in a comeback mode, isn't that kind of everybody's introduction to football America anymore?
it kind of is now. It's a rite of passage, a very sad rite
really
of passage.
It really is, and it's unreal.
Yeah. Well, let's start with that one. Let's make that topic number one.
Number one.
This is the Jaguars and the Patriots. And, let's talk about the comeback. Let's talk about Tom Brady here. When it was halftime in this game, obviously the Patriots are down 4. Well, they were down 11 before they mounted that last drive to get on the board as far as that touchdown went. But no Gronk. And we talked about this a couple times this year. They were without Gronk last year, but they had Martellus Bennett. They don't have a Gronk replacement. They don't have a Gronk light to plug into the lineup when Gronk was out. And it seemed like going against what is maybe the best back seven in football, it seemed like that was going to be really problematic.
Yeah, it would. And Dwayne Allen, you didn't even notice he was on the field once they were out there. I mean, there were times I thought, hey, are they in four receivers yet? Because I haven't noticed a tight end. You had to search and find Dwayne Allen in the formation. So it was a three receiver offense for New England. And you know what this game reminds? Last week we saw the most incredible ending, or one of the most that we've seen. And that was the Vikings' comeback. And that's kind of the miracle story of comebacks, and we can think of all the great plays over history. With all these New England comebacks, can you think of one dramatic, defining play? Because the incredible part of them is they don't just happen in a wow moment.
Yes.
There's nothing fluky. They just come back on you. They just keep playing the way they play and eventually win the game. Against Atlanta last year, they didn't have any plays that went longer than 28 yards, and they came back. And it was like that again in this game. There were no big turning moments. New England just sticks with their concepts. Brady gets very comfortable throwing out of three receiver sets, even if Gronkowski's not out there in this case. And it works. Their concepts work. He plays right on schedule. Their receivers make plays. It's just unfathomable how well refined and well tuned this machine has become.
And the fact that it's always sustained. It's never, like you said, it's never some fluky long play that a defender falling down and a guy breaking loose or something like that.
Yeah.
The flukiest thing I can think of in the Brady the Brady legend, I guess it is at this point, it would be the Tuck rule play, which was but that wasn't like a big play. I mean, it was an important play and it was a good break, but it wasn't like a 60-yard touchdown or something like that. But
even his first comeback against the Rams was a bunch of dinking and dunking on that final drive where it just kind of changed the way we view the check down. Brady's one of the best check down throwers of all time, and those check downs that gain 5 yards for most guys gain 8 to 12 yards for the Patriots, and that's a huge factor when you're playing from behind. That one wasn't as big a deal this game. I thought where the game swung, and not in one big swoop, but where it kind of changed directions. Obviously, when Jacksonville had the delay of game coming out of the timeout,
yeah,
when they were near scoring range, utterly inexcusable, and they would have converted that play as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then New England went downfield and they drew some penalties. I guess these Jaguars are up in arms about the discrepancy in penalties that were called in the game. Here's what we can't emphasize enough. 90% of penalties in the NFL are a product of good play by one team, and the team that got defeated creates the penalty in trying to overcome it, making a bad play. Offensive lineman gets beat, he holds. Cornerback gets beat, he commits pass interference. It's a lot of good plays that create penalties. They're not mistakes in the NFL more as they are just creations by good plays. Having said that, I thought the A.J. Bouye downfield pass interference on Brandon Cooks, you could argue that fell into the 10% where it was a bad play defensively. And more than that, I don't know if I love the call. And Doug Marrone, I don't think, loved the call. He kind of hinted at that at halftime. That was a huge moment in the game. That changed the tenor of that part of the game, which changed the rest of the game. And I thought Bouye had ran Cooks legally into the sideline, and to call pass interference when a receiver's on the white chalk, which is basically what they did, I didn't love that. But that's not what won the game. But I thought that's kind of where the flow of the game altered.
No, I totally agree. I thought that was, if you were going to point to something egregious as an officiating mistake, I thought that was the closest thing to it. It was, you know, it was justifiable, but probably should not have drawn a flag. You know, there was some griping out of this game coming from the Jaguars locker room that they had backed off in the second half as far as defensively. They had sat back in more zone. Did you get that sense? And I mean, I don't know. I honestly... Well, what's your answer to that first? And then we'll sort of transition to part two here.
Well, my answer is they've done that all season long, and it took them to the AFC Championship. I mean, that's how they play. They're a cover four team. They've done a little more cover four late in the season. They're predominantly cover three. That's what they do.
Number two.
Let's transition to topic two here, because that sort of goes into this. Topic two, we're going to talk about what the Jaguars did, what they accomplished offensively in this game, and then maybe what they didn't accomplish in the second half of this game. And I had a radio spot at halftime of this game with Brent Musburger's new network out in Las Vegas, and they were kind of asking, well, what do you do with Bortles in the second half? You know, do you keep attacking with Bortles? And it was kind of like, no, probably not. I don't think I'd do that. I don't think I'd do the heat check with Blake Bortles. I think they had some things in their pocket in the first half of this game that they pulled out. I think they sort of ran out of arrows in the quiver as the second half went. And, you know, Bortles had a couple of near misses. I mean, this was a game of near misses in the second half for the Jaguars. But I don't know. I don't know how much more they could have done. You know, you can look back and say, well, yeah, they should have done something because they lost the game. But I don't know, you know, if they were in the exact same situation next January. I don't know if there's anything where you'd say, like, oh, we have to do A, B, and C differently than we did the last time around.
Yeah, no, I think Bortles, what he is a very, potentially, at his best, he's a very good complementary quarterback, which means he's a quarterback that needs the running game. He needs play-action passing where the rhythm is kind of built into the play design and the reads become defined. You need to put him on the move as part of that, let him use his legs at times, and that's what he is. What he did well in this game, and I thought he played excellent. He missed two or three throws here or there. Brady did too, by the way. His receivers made some incredible catches. Gronk had one down the seam. Amendola had like four or five. He's done that for a number of years now. So it's, you know, the quarterback discrepancy was not huge. Bortles did his part. The Jaguars just got beat. I thought what changed in the second half, New England, they're very diverse and they can be aggressive with some of their run fronts. They have excellent run defending defensive linemen and Lawrence Guy and especially Malcolm Brown, and those guys clog the middle more. And then New England got aggressive with its blitzing, which is not how they've played much this season. And the two things they did were they brought stack linebacker blitzes. I think James Harrison came on one. I know Landon Roberts and Kyle Van Noy came on some. So they put blitzers in Bortles' face, and then they had those two cornerback blitzes on third down and eight that both resulted in stops. They looked like man coverage, and they turned into corner blitzes, which is a little unusual, but it's unusual for New England. They don't do that a lot, and it worked. So the Patriots changed the game. by becoming the aggressors. And Jacksonville's running game wasn't quite what it was. The play-action game wasn't quite what it was. You know, when they're blitzing and you're in play-action, that can be a little unsettling because of how long play-action takes to unfold.
Yeah.
Those blitzers can get on you. I mean, remember that Rodney McLeod sack last week against the Falcons late in the game, a first down blitz, which the Eagles never do, but it was against play action. We've seen that a few times in this postseason. So I thought that's what changed the most was the way New England approached things. And the Jaguars, they didn't fall on their face in response, but they weren't good enough in response.
Yeah. No, there were two throws late. Obviously, the Stephon Gilmore deflection was a huge one. I mean, that you know, that ball's a couple inches away from being a game-winning touchdown. I thought it was a little bit, I don't know, funny, depending on what side of this you were on. You know, Jacksonville, they're rotating these backs, and all three guys did some nice things today. Fournette's the guy I'd want in there as a pass protector. And Yeldon's the guy I want in there running at, you know, some sort of downfield route. And, you know, it was that sort of scramble play, and Fournette had taken off downfield and, you know, throw just a little too far inside. And I wondered if, you know, if that's Yeldon running downfield, that might be a completion there. That might be a big completion. And now we're in business if you're the Jaguars. Right after that play, Fournette comes off the field, probably because he just had to sprint downfield, and Yeldon comes in and, you know, gets steamrolled in a blitz pickup, and Bortles gets sacked, and that's just kind of the way it broke in the fourth quarter for this team.
Did you call a few sentences ago, you called a route a root?
I did call it a root. I don't know why I called
Aaron
it that.
Schatz is the only other guy in the media I've ever heard do that, and he's a Boston guy. He's watched this Patriot game, I'm sure. He calls it root running, and it's not wrong. I think Tony Kornheiser does it, but I've never heard you do it, and I'm sure you've said route on this show. What changed today? What is this now how you're speaking?
I've been in the car for a long time the last 2 days and maybe just driving on all the different routes in New England to go all over the place. Yeah.
They're good root runners in New England there. This was a fun game. Is there anything else to say on it? I mean, is there anything else? What I love about games like this is when everybody remains within their identity. And we're about to talk about the Eagles and Vikings and a certain guy on the Eagles who got totally outside of his identity and won the game for him. And that can be fun at times, too. But I love it when teams play within the context of how they played all season long. Both sides play great games, and we just get to see who wins and how it shakes out. I thought this game totally symbolized that.
It really did. It was a good game. We're I'm not going to let you transition that easily to Eagles-Vikings. I have a couple of programming notes here first, and we're going to talk about Bortles and the future of the Jaguars a little bit later in the show. Before we move on, though, just want to mention we have a special show and potentially special shows coming up between now and the Super Bowl. We're going to do a mailbag show. It's going to be something different. Send your questions in. We're obviously, look, you can send in whatever questions you want, but we're going to prioritize Super Bowl stuff. And if there are great non-Super Bowl questions, we might get to them, but it's probably going to be a Super Bowl mailbag show. But we are doing something different on the second half of that show. We have a bunch of our colleagues, Kalen Kaler, Jenny Vrentis, Tim Rohan, are out on the road. They're driving out to Minneapolis for Super Bowl 52. They're going to get some stories on the way, and they're going to share them with us. And we're going to try something new on the second half of this podcast. So we're going to answer your questions. Andy and I are going to do our thing, and we're going to have a little something different on the back end. And hopefully you like it. And if you do, maybe we'll do it again before the 2 weeks are up here and the Super Bowl actually gets played. We'll also have the traditional deep dive show previewing the Super Bowl next week, and we will have a mini preview of the Super Bowl in this very show if you keep on listening. And that was a really clumsy plug for it. But check out that show on Friday. We're excited about it. It's going to be something different and new, and that's always exciting because we've kind of done the same thing for the last 3 years.
We like the mailbag shows too. Send your mailbag questions. You guys, listeners, do, and I'm not flattering you. Our listeners do a great job with these mailbag questions.
They do. And by the way, you can send them Twitter, ggramling_si, Andy_Benoit, or you can email them to talkback@themqb.com, or you can send them via Facebook, or if you can think of a different way, you can do that too.
Number 3.
Nick Foles, look, Andy, you said it. This was a new Nick Foles in this game. This was Nick Foles doing a lot of unexpected things.
It was unreal. It was absolutely unreal. And I'm up, staying up late tonight. I'm writing a Nick Foles thing for the magazine. And Adam Dorson, the editor for the magazine, the NFL section, he called me in kind of, it wasn't a panic, but there was an urgency between both of us because Nick Foles played exactly the opposite way that we expected. And I'd already started writing some of the article to get the body of it moving. And now the body totally contradicts the NFC Championship, and we have to figure out what to say and what to do with that. And that's the equation Bill Belichick's going to have to deal with as they get ready for the Super Bowl, is which Nick Foles do we believe? The one that we've seen most of this season and for most of his career, where the later in the down it gets, the worse he becomes, at least the less comfortable he becomes? Or do we believe in the Nick Foles tonight that looked exactly like Carson Wentz looked for this team for the first 3 months of the season?
It was. My two favorite throws, one of them was the 53-yarder to Alshon Jeffrey late in the first half. They scored 10 points in, like, the final minute of the first half. It was that kind of night. But, yeah, that
was an incredible play. That was a great play.
And he kept on patting it and patting it. And, obviously, you know, we're watching the broadcast angle. We don't know what's happening downfield. And when he finally just launched it deep, I was like, okay, it's a throwaway, or that's basically, you know, his third down. That's basically going to be a punt. It's going to get intercepted and you know, it'll be a 40-yard interception, and we'll move on. But,
here's what happened downfield on that one. Because, fortunately, the replay from the end zone or the sky cam, whatever they call that, it used to be spider cam, but the back end zone look at that on the Fox replay, Minnesota played cover two on the trip side. And the Eagles had three routes, two of them past the sticks, one underneath, and the Vikings did a tremendous job defending the routes past the sticks. They've done that all season long. They often play cover two in those scenarios over there. And that's where Foles' reads were. And the ball should have been out right there. And there was really nowhere to throw. Probably the correct quarterback play would have been to check it down. I think it was either Ertz or Trey Burton underneath the sticks. Mm-hmm. And you complete it for 5 yards and move on. He extended the play within the pocket, sliding to his left very calmly, and looked on the other side. And the other side, there were fewer receivers, and the Vikings were in quarters coverage over there. So cover four, quarters, same thing, and cover two on the other. They call that cover six. Terrence Newman and cover four there, you play it like man-to-man, basically, when you're out wide against Jeffrey. And Newman dominated Jeffrey on the dig route, which was the play design. But because Foles moved in the pocket and extended it, the play now went beyond its design, and Jeffrey alertly took his route upfield, and Newman looked like a 39-year-old trying to transition to move with that. Most cornerbacks would get beat there. So that's an example of superstar quarterbacking traits. That's not saying Foles is a superstar, but the guy before him did that all the time. And that's why Carson Wentz is going to have an unbelievable career. That's the kind of thing I don't think you can teach that, Gary.
It was wild. He had a really nice, my other favorite play, he had I think it was like a 15-yard completion to Zach Ertz on a third and long, where he had to step up and then threw off his back foot. And that's, I mean, that should be a recipe for disaster.
He was making throws from noisy pockets. And as the game went on, Minnesota's pass rush got a little more effective, not late, but we're talking middle of the game, second quarter, third quarter especially, and Foles just reacted perfectly to the noise. And Philadelphia's O-line overall defeated Minnesota's D-line. Let's not let's not obfuscate this here. But when the line didn't, when the blocking potentially could have broken down, Foles made his linemen right by the way he moved in the pocket. It was just a tremendous display. And it's the exact opposite of what we've seen from him. And the Eagles are saying now, Ben Baskin was in the locker room afterwards, one of our SI writers, and he asked some questions for me to these guys, and it was about Foles playing late into the down, and they're saying, oh, Nick's been doing this all year, he's like that. No, he hasn't.
Maybe in practice when he's got the red jersey on.
Maybe the 7-on-7 drill where there's no pass rush at all, maybe then. But Doug Peterson, coaches tell you how they feel about their players by the plays they call. And Doug Peterson's installed all these run-pass options, these quick throws, this underneath stuff, the throws to Jay Ajayi, all these throws that take the game out of Foles' hands because he knows what Nick Foles is. And now tonight, Nick Foles takes the game into his own hands, and some of these routes get extended, and they did it like four or five times. And the Ertz play that you mentioned was another one of them. And what's interesting, Gary, we always say in the NFL, it will be third down and long at some point in every game. And those are big moments, and your quarterback has to make plays. You can't hide the quarterback in third and long very easily. And when Peterson didn't tonight, he couldn't, and Foles rewarded him for letting him play.
Yeah, just a boy, what a night. God, you got to be feeling so good if you're an Eagles fan right now.
Number four.
Topic number four, let's go on. Let's talk about what the Eagles' defense did to the Vikings' offense in this game. Because, I mean, look, it started with the Vikings opened this game with a touchdown drive. You know, the Eagles are having some communication problems in the linebacking core. You know, looked like it might be another decent game from Case Keenum, and then it all kind of fell apart. Two big turnovers, obviously, in the first half made a big difference here. But, you know, this Eagles front just continues to dominate, and they really didn't have any issues on the back end.
No. We said going into the game that I thought Minnesota was the better all-around team, and I didn't know their defense would collapse over these last six quarters of the season, which they have. That's unfortunate, but in the big aggregate picture, Minnesota, I thought, was a better all-around team. But Minnesota's top weakness, which right now is that offensive line and how it's been reshuffled because of the injury to Nick Easton at left guard, that biggest weakness correlated with Philly's greatest strength, which is obviously their defensive line, and how will that play out and what will that mean? And that first drive, it looked like Minnesota was going to do what Nick Foles did and just overachieve tremendously. I mean, they dominated in the run game, and then Pat Shurmur had that really good shift with Latavius Murray out wide out of 21 personnel, two back, one tight end, and they got the touchdown to Rudolph because the Eagles in their base coverages probably haven't seen that formation and that shift from Minnesota all season long. They didn't have a plan for it, you could tell. And so it looked like, wow, Vikings at their very best. They're winning with the run game, which they're not very good at, but they insist on always running the ball anyway, and it's kind of worked out for them. And then here they are manufacturing plays via their design on offense, which Pat Shurmur's been doing all season long. And little did we know, that's the last we'd see of the Vikings tonight. That right there. And then when they did move the ball, they had the turnovers, and that stemmed from those offensive linemen to a degree getting beat by the defensive lineman. The one where it wasn't a lineman was tight end David Morgan getting beat by Barnett on that sack fumble, which was a huge play in the game, probably the turning point in the game, in fact. That still qualifies to a degree as offensive line getting beat by defensive line. It's a weirder blocking concept, but you know.
Yeah, how does that end up? Because that's a tough block, tight end on defensive end anyway, but Morgan had to come
cross
a long
the
way to make that block.
Yeah, I know. It's my guess, I don't know this, but Malcolm Jenkins had been blitzing by Philly standards quite a bit so far in that game. They're not a big blitzing team, but when they do blitz, Jim Schwartz is pretty aggressive about it. And Malcolm Jenkins had caused some problems as a blitzer. My guess is the Vikings were taking provisions in the event of a blitz coming, because that's about the only reason you would ever block a defensive end with your tight end crossing the formation. You do that because you're sliding your entire offensive line away from that defensive end, which means you're sliding it towards where you think the blitz is coming from. You wouldn't slide your line otherwise, and even if you're helping the defensive end or the tight end's a blocker, you're not having him cross the formation and then cut block someone. That's not a regular protection call.
Yeah.
So I think they were worried about Jenkins blitzing in the game, and that's a great job by Jim Schwartz of taking control, and really that's a perfect illustration of the defense dictating the terms of engagement.
Yeah. And look, a little bit later in the show, we're going to talk about what the Vikings have to do this offseason. They obviously have some interesting decisions to make at quarterback. We're also going to talk about some of the coaching hires of the past week, including Pat Shurmur, all but officially going to be the new guy in New York with the Giants. But before we move on, you know, we all live busy lives, and unfortunately there's not enough hours in the day to get everything done. So thank goodness there's Freshly, the easiest and most convenient way to eat healthy no matter what life throws your way. Freshly's team of chefs create all-natural, gluten-free dinners and deliver them fresh to your door. So even if you get stuck late at work, you can still come home to a delicious dinner cooked by a chef. No more worrying about having to figure out what's for dinner, and especially no mess to clean up afterward. I mean, look, the food they have is just phenomenal. The peppercorn steak is good, but the buffalo chicken and the loaded cauliflower, that's great. That's some of the best stuff I've had. Their menu is created by chefs for people who want to eat healthy but are living busy lives and don't always have time to shop, cook, or clean. The best part about Freshly is the number of comfort meals they currently have that are also super healthy, like the aforementioned buffalo chicken. Customize your weekly meals from their constantly changing, rotating menu of more than 30 chef-created options. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Every single meal comes with a detailed and easy-to-read overview of each ingredient featured in the meal. Trust me, there's nothing better than knowing that no matter what happens in my daily life, I have a chef-cooked dinner waiting for me at home. Check out this week's menu created by Freshly Chefs and get $25 off your first order of 6 chef-cooked dinners, plus free shipping by going to freshly.com/10things. That's 10things. You'll feel so relieved to come home to a chef-cooked meal every night with Freshly. That's freshly.com/10things, 10things, for $25 off your first order. Order today to see what life's like when you no longer have to think about dinner.
Number 5.
All right, Andy, topic number 5. We're going to do it. We're going to do the mini preview right here of Super Bowl 52. We will, of course, have the deep dive show next week where we break it down in much more depth, which is why we call it the deep dive. And we're going to have the mailbag show, at least one. First one will be Friday, maybe the only one, but at least the first one will be on Friday. So send those questions in. All right, Super Bowl mini preview, Super Bowl 52. Just give me your overall impressions of this matchup right now, Andy.
Well, which side of the ball do we think is more important? Let's start with that.
I would be interested. We've seen in the past the Patriots can be beaten when teams really put the heat on Brady, especially at the middle there, and the Eagles have the front four to be able to do that.
Yeah, they do. They absolutely do. And I think we know what the Eagles will play on the back end. They've been playing a lot of cover three zone lately, and maybe they played a little more man-to-man tonight than usual. Some of that is because they blitzed a little more than usual. But I think anytime you face New England, the conversation begins with, does the defense have the formula to compete with Tom Brady? And they do. Now, that doesn't mean Philadelphia's going to own the game. Jacksonville also had the formula. Jacksonville's a more talented unit defensively than New England is offensively. Brady just happens to be the quarterback, and that's kind of a big deal. I'm most interested to see what we're going to get out of Nick Foles and what the Patriots will game plan for Foles, and will they choose to treat him as the Nick Foles we saw tonight, which might seem like, oh, it's isolated, why, you know, that's just one game, but the stuff he did, that can terrify a coach, right? That's coach-killing stuff that he does when he extends a play and makes your coverage when it's right still go wrong. Or will they treat him like they've seen for much of Nick Foles' career? I'm sure they'll watch a lot of his film, and not just from this season, dating back to other seasons. They might even watch his film when he's not with the Eagles. I don't know. But it'll be interesting to find that out. And it was interesting late in the fourth quarter of this game against Jacksonville, Gary. It was 3rd-and-9. New England basically decided, we're going to punt the ball and make Blake Bortles beat us. So Blake Bortles had his best day as a pro, and yet the Patriots were comfortable just giving him the ball back with 90 yeah. seconds to go and saying, we don't think you can go 80 yards against us. So they treated Blake Bortles like the Blake Bortles they saw on film more than the Blake Bortles they'd seen that afternoon, which leads me to believe that they'll probably treat Foles like the Foles we've seen more rather than the Foles in the championship. But I guarantee you, when they sit down and watch that championship film, Foles did some stuff that's going to scare the hell out of them. And will that impact some of their game planning?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, I guess they have to play it conservatively as possible, as they kind of do typically. When you know you're going to get 24, 30 points or so out of Brady no matter what, you just kind of dare, you know, it was Bortles on Sunday and it'll be Foles, and you sort of dare them to, put together a couple of long drives against you and try and go shot for shot with Brady, and you just kind of assume that you know, even on the best days of their lives, they're not going to be able to do that. Yeah, I don't know.
And I think they also realize that Philly's best chance, just like with Jacksonville's, will be to make a big play defensively, which Jacksonville did not get in this game. But I don't know. This is the greatness of Tom Brady. So typically when a team knows that the opponent's best chance is to get a big play and maybe win that way, take Jacksonville in their wild card game versus Buffalo, for example, the team that knows that becomes very conservative because they're not going to let that big play come easily. The Patriots don't have to do that because of how good Brady is. You could argue they're better when they're not conservative because of how good Brady is, and it's safer to play that way. Safer to be aggressive with Brady than conservative with Brady.
Yeah. As far as I guess we kind of touched on Foles right there. I mean, that run game, that Eagles versus run game, does that give the Patriots fits?
I don't think it gives them fits. There's a lot to prepare for. You have to prepare for wham and trap plays, which the Patriots run a lot themselves. So that defense saw that in training camp. You have to prepare for inside zone and outside zone and then some unique gap scheme runs. One thing I think we will see from New England are the reduced fronts that they had some success with against Jacksonville. What we mean by a reduced front is a bear front or something similar where you take your defensive tackles and play them tighter inside, and you usually have a nose tackle. So the three interior linemen all have defenders right over them. And I think we'll see that because Jason Kelce, who I had first team all pro, so I'm a supporter, but before this season, teams dominated him when they aligned a nose tackle directly over him. For whatever reason, I'd love to ask Doug Peterson what he thinks the reason is, teams have not played a nose tackle as much against Philadelphia this year as they did in previous years. But if you put Malcolm Brown or Alan Branch, if he's healthy, one of those two guys, right over Jason Kelce, that will disrupt a lot of what Philadelphia does, especially with their perimeter running game. And if New England knows they can get the Eagles out of their perimeter running game, now it becomes easier to defend their interior running game.
Yeah. Before we move on to topic six, I just want to say real quick, we've gone through half the show. We didn't mention Brady's hand at all. And that's all anyone talked about nonstop for 96
hours. Isn't that nice? Yeah. Yeah, that's nice.
It is. It is. It ended up being nothing, like everyone suspected it was.
We got 2 weeks of Rob Gronkowski's head now as the topic at hand. We get 2 weeks of that. Every year there's a guy... There's one guy with an injury going into the Super Bowl, and he becomes a story. I remember Dwight Freeney's ankle going into the Super Bowl against the Saints and how that was talked about ad nauseum. It's going to be Rob Gronkowski's concussion. And you know, I mean, no one wants to talk about injuries, but you know concussion especially is the one they don't want to talk about.
Yeah. Here's the thing about concussion, though. And I actually talked to Freeney about that injury specifically, like 2 years ago when we did it was Super Bowl 50. So we were talking about that game, that Super Bowl, and he said the problem with being injured for the Super Bowl is, you know, they get you all ready with what they do to you with various, you know, injections and whatnot. And then you play, and then you have the super long halftime. And during the super long halftime, you just can't keep it warm. He said, you know, he was in the locker room. He's on the bike. He's trying to keep warm. But when that adrenaline's not going, you can't really fake it. And when he went out for the second half, it just, you know, it all sort of reverted to what it had been before. Before he had gotten the tour at all and whatnot. I don't know if he specifically took
We suspected that's what happened with Alex Mack last year. We thought Alex Mack had that issue last year with the Falcons. What was his injury? What, he had a shoulder or an ankle? I can't remember what it was.
He wasn't the same in the second half.
I remember that.
He had a knee, I think it was.
Between the shoulder and ankle. Right between them.
We just threw out basically every body part right there, and I'm not even really that sure. Fractured fibula. So, yeah, broken leg. There it is. Yeah, we'll do it in hockey terms.
Right between the ankle and knee as we work our way down.
Yes. He had a, this is the NHL, he had a body injury, and that's what they'd term it.
Number six.
Topic number six here. Let's talk about the Jaguars and their upcoming offseason. Obviously, I mean, you have to be you're disappointed if you're a Jacksonville fan today, but you got to be excited about the future. The defense is set, and this might be, you know, we talked earlier this season about, you know, is the Legion of Boom, is what they had in Seattle, is that not going to be what it was? Or is that sort of closing there? And this might be sort of the new Legion of Boom, if we're going to brand things lazily.
That Legion of Boom, I just went through Seattle's contract situation yesterday looking at their whole roster. I did that for the whole NFL. And the Legion of Boom's not on its deathbed, but we're putting it in an assisted living home at this point. I mean, there are guys that are older, they've been hurt, and there's a lot of guys who their contracts are up, and it's inevitable that it's going to go away in a year or two if it hasn't started to really fade already. So yeah, Jacksonville is the new Legion of Boom, so to speak. I think that secondary is that good. It's as good as Seattle's was. They're better at corner overall than those Seahawks, and they are just as fast in the front seven. The conversation for Jacksonville's offseason is going to be, what do you do with Blake Bortles? And I think you have to bring him back now because, I think he's worth playing with. They've gotten comfortable figuring out how to play with him, what's best for him. When he's on, he does throw the ball well. You just don't know if he's going to be on at any given week. But what would it say to the rest of the locker room if the quarterback plays as well as he did over the last 2 weeks of these playoffs, beating the Steelers, almost beating the Patriots, and giving it, you know, playing about as well as you can ask? If they don't reward that guy and they don't bring him back, I think it'd be hard to develop team chemistry if that guy doesn't get rewarded. Because then how will I get rewarded? What do you have to do to impress Tom Coughlin around here? That becomes a little bit of the rumblings.
It's tricky. And look, it's a little bit of a blessing that, you know, it's a fifth-year option, so they don't need to make a contract decision on him, really. It's not like you have to sign him to a long-term deal. It's almost like a mini-franchise tag at this point. Yeah, it's weird. You know, they all publicly they've supported him. They're very defensive of him, and you know, he doesn't really care about all the criticism he gets. But guys in the locker room will talk about how much it bothers them, the criticism he gets. But that was not really how it was playing out last summer, when it looked like. And look, we had this story. We were starting to work on it. We were prepping it. We had a couple people pass through Jacksonville, and it was going to be Chad Henne. Chad Henne was going to overtake him if he played even, you know, a serviceable brand of football in that third preseason game, and he didn't, and they turned back to Bortles, and now it's all history. But I think there were a lot of guys. It was a tenuous situation. I think there were a lot of guys who were ready to move on and were kind of done with Bortles, but. If you had been in a coma since 2015 or so, and you woke up yesterday and you just caught this game today, you'd be like, oh, I guess Bortles worked out pretty well. So we'll see what happens.
welcome out of your coma, too.
Yes.
It'd be a tough thing.
We're glad you're back. You know, let's say Kirk Cousins checked in. It was just kind of like, hey, you know, Tom Coughlin, I'll come down there. I want to be a part of what you have down there. Would you make that move? Hypothetical, no. Of course. As
Bortles is
on any report.
Bortles is more talented than Bortles is more talented than Cousins. He has the longer throwing motion, so he's inherently less consistent, and that matters. I mean, that matters a lot. I don't know if I do that though, because in order to get Cousins, I have to make a long term commitment, and I think Cousins around the NFL is seen as good, not great, and that's kind of his ceiling, and. That might be Bortles' ceiling too, but they don't have to decide that now. They can get him on a 1 year deal next year and just figure this out later. And I think the other thing, Gary, and I think the reason they will do it that way is part of the reason, and this might have something to do with why guys around the NFL pick on Bortles, and he seems to be the one quarterback that it's okay to just talk bad about. Nobody else talks bad about any QBs around the league. But there's the perception that he maybe isn't always the most mature guy off the field, and that's probably changed this year. He looks like he's been more mature from afar, the way he's playing, and we're guessing, I guess. But I bet they want to see how he handles the success this offseason, and what is his mindset coming into the next year. Who do we have? What kind of leader do we have there?
Yeah. Do you ever watch The Good Place, the show on NBC, Ted Danson and Kristen Bell?
I've stopped watching network television shows because they play to the mass audience so much, which means they're stupid.
I
tend to watch like the cable shows and the Netflix shows.
I'm in that boat. This one is unique, and I was very reluctant to pick it up because it just it's, you know, it's on NBC and it's like, I don't know, it's an NBC show. They just do a bunch of, I don't know, dramas about Chicago, it seems like. And then they have this other show. But yeah, I picked it up like a couple months ago, and it's a half hour long, so it's easier to find time to watch it, and it's really good. But the reason I'm talking about it is there's just like a running Blake Bortles joke throughout that show. And it's kind of like,
really?
I don't know, Blake Bortles is kind of like a punchline.
Well, it's like, and maybe
mainstream.
That'll always be that way. Yeah, I don't. Tim McCarver was the punchline in broadcasting for a long time, and I think he was one of the most respected broadcasters within broadcasting. Outside of broadcasting was a little bit of a different story. Maybe Bortles becomes sort of the Tim McCarver. It's going to be nothing he can ever do right, and that's his life now.
It's the strangest analogy I think we've ever done. He's going to be the Tim McCarver of quarterbacks.
I thought McCarver was good, but I'm not a baseball guy either. But people I respect thought he was good too.
I didn't really have enough of an opinion on him. I know what his reputation was, and I think I was too young to appreciate really good or really bad when he was still doing games. And he never really did Orioles games because they never in the playoffs.
Number 7.
All right, Andy. Topic number 7. Let's talk Vikings.
Another quarterback team.
This is the story of the offseason. I mean, this is incredible. All three guys. My guess is they franchise Keenum, and the other two guys move on. But yeah,
the only thing that you wonder is Mike Zimmer makes no bones about it, but Sam Bradford's their best thrower. And if Pat Shurmur's leaving, is Case Keenum still Case Keenum? And that doesn't mean that they think Shurmur made Keenum, but they played a very specific brand of football. And I think the question that almost as much as the importance of the quarterback one is, who's going to coordinate the offense now? Are they going to promote from within? If they do that, then they probably need to go Kevin Stefanski, their quarterback's coach, who just took that job this year. And he's a little bit of a younger coach, but he's been there a long time, and he's coached a lot of different positions. So maybe they feel with that. But if they don't feel that he's ready, if they want him to be a QB coach a little longer, they've got to hire someone from the outside. And who is that someone? And can they do what Shurmur does? Because we've seen a lot of teams this year, Gary, where you change the coach and it's a drastic change for the good or for the worse. And who you have a coordinator, I'm convinced that matters more than ever now, because play design has become such a big deal in the league. And you got to know that before you know what you do at QB, and they probably will. You don't leave your coordinator position open very long.
Yeah. I think they can't trust Bradford to stay healthy. And I think there's a chance they can keep Bridgewater on a much lesser deal. I don't know what kind of demand there's going to be for Bridgewater. I figure anywhere he goes, he's a competition guy, as opposed to we're bringing this guy in as our starter. But
I agree. I think Teddy Bridgewater's a high-level backup. If we're just looking at his skill set, can he work in the right offense? Sure. Of course, yeah. But that would have to be a specific offense, and he'd have to be very much a complementary piece. Of those three guys, I think he's the least talented thrower of Keenum, Bradford, and Bridgewater. I think Bridgewater's the least talented thrower. He's not a strong-armed guy at all.
No. Well, this is
they love him though. They love
out.
Him
they
in
do.
That building.
And that's the thing. And I don't think that was a matter of smoke screens or anything like that. I think they were seriously sitting there in whatever it was, mid-November and December, and saying, Keenum, if he strings together a bad game and a half, we're ready to go with Bridgewater. I mean, they adore him there.
I can tell you they do, and part of it, honestly, is that some of those coaches have been in place for a while, and they remember, or at least there are enough people around who remember the Christian Ponder years. And when Bridgewater showed up, Ponder was so frenetic in the pocket, and there was a scattershot nature to the way he played. And when Bridgewater showed up, there wasn't. And this is kind of the Russell Wilson discussion, and people don't like to hear this, but coaches love it when the quarterback is not scattershot. Even if he's a great scattershot player, they don't like scattershot because it makes it hard to do their job, and they don't know what to expect. So when Bridgewater showed up, he at least gave coaches a sense of grounding. They knew what to expect, and that was so refreshing within the building. And then you add Teddy Bridgewater's personality, which people liked. Kind of an understated guy. I think people who are outside of the team think, oh, he's meek. That was the word I heard about him. He's too meek. But I think within the team, they like him, and they like that he's comfortable and easy to be around. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, Teddy Bridgewater is the savior of the team, which is good for them that they love their quarterback. But you want to be careful about loving your quarterback more than the rest of the league does.
Yeah, I think they can sort of let him test the market and see what happens. I think he's a guy that they can bring back. And just, you know, I haven't really looked that deeply into their roster situation, but I know they have a lot of cap space with those three quarterbacks getting out there. So you can franchise Keenum, and then if you can get Bridgewater on a pretty team friendly deal, you just have the both of them back.
Yeah. Yeah, I would. So, I mean, Bradford gets away. Someone's going to sign Sam Bradford to be a starter again. That's like the theme of every other offseason.
Yeah, he makes a lot of money. Yeah, where would he go? And would you? I mean, would you invest in him? I mean, I guess you'd have to treat him as a bridge guy at this point. He can't stay in the lineup.
Well, then, even if he's a bridge guy, what good is he to you then? I mean, if a quarterback can't stay on the field, then I wouldn't invest in him. Yeah, I love the skill set. I do. But the skill set's not on the field enough. I don't know.
Denver? You think Denver might scrape him up?
I think if Elway's going to bring in an outside QB, he's going to bring in who he thinks would be the best. And maybe he does think – I mean, Elway, he knows the value of a strong arm. And Bradford's stronger arm than Cousins, so maybe he would do that. And then if it doesn't work out, they're in the same QB situation as they were this year. But I think their QB situation probably spooked them this season. I think they know that Trevor Siemian is a backup, and – they have no idea what Paxton Lynch is, which is unsettling, even though there hasn't been a lot of time to see him yet because we knew he'd need a year. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see. This free agent QB market, it's not what it's being made out to be. It's not going to reshape the NFL because Breeze isn't going to leave, and mm-hmm. Cousins, I think, is good, not great, as we've said. But there are starters who will move and relocate, and it'll be interesting to see which teams invest in that because we don't see starters relocating very often.
It will. Before we move on to the coaches, Andy, and all you guys out there, let me tell you about Mattress Firm. Let's keep the ball rolling, shall we? Everyone knows how important stretching is before an event. So does Mattress Firm, except it's your dollar. Your budget stretches further when you're shopping at America's Neighborhood Mattress Store. It's a true home run, and you'll have a ball. They're the head coaches when it comes to mattress expertise, but know this, they are more than mattress experts. They have a game plan that helps you transform your mattress into a bed, from adjustable bases and sheets to headboards and bedroom decor. They have you literally and figuratively covered up like your favorite cornerback. Go to mattressfirm.com/podcast to see what deals are happening as I read this sentence to you. They even offer you a 120-night sleep trial to ensure perfection and a 120-night low price guarantee so you know you paid the perfect price. Talk about a 1-2 punch, a knockout, if you will. Score big with a perfect bed. Head to mattressfirm.com/podcast to get the play-by-play on how you can monumentally improve your sleep today, tonight, and tomorrow.
Number 8.
All right, topic number 8, Andy. We're going to do two mini lightning rounds here. It's such small lightning rounds that they're going to have like two items each. But we're talking coaches now. A bunch of hirings here. Let's start with Pat Shurmur. to the Giants, by all reports. I mean, is Eli his guy in 2018, you think?
Oh, yeah. Eli Manning's not slowing down. There was no evidence of that on film last season. He was caught in a very bad situation on a number of fronts, and some of that's going to get solved naturally, changing the system with Shurmur coming in and having the receivers back healthy. And those wide receivers, I mean, just think about replacing Odell or Stephon Diggs with Odell Beckham, for one, or let's say Diggs and or Diggs becomes Sterling Shepard and Thielen becomes Odell Beckham for Shurmur. I mean, that's going to work fine, just fine. And then Evan Engram gives more flexibility at tight end than what Shurmur's had recently. I love the match. I think it's great. I don't know about Shurmur's personality. I mean, I don't know. I don't know him. I haven't heard a lot about that. It was interesting, though. Mike Holmgren said earlier this week publicly, and Holmgren had employed Shurmur when he was the Browns head coach, Shurmur, that is. He said, I hope he takes things more relaxed this time, or he's more flexible, whatever it was that he said. Basically, don't have a stick so far up you. We'll find out. Other Cleveland coaches have learned to relax in their next stop, and it's worked for them before.
How drastic a change is this for Eli Manning going from a Ben McAdoo system to a Shurmur system?
I don't think it's drastic because Eli at this point has been in so many systems, and Shurmur is not overly complex. What he does are very basic things in a nice, smooth, nuanced way. They don't ask you to make complicated reads. In fact, they simplify the game for the QB because they are so well designed. I think Manning will transition into Shurmur's system seamlessly.
Yeah. No, I'm excited to get a full season, or hopefully a full season, of Odell Beckham Jr. and Evan Engram, because they really didn't have them when Engram was sort of full-fledged last year before Beckham got hurt.
Yeah.
Matt Patricia to the Lions, which I feel like this was the one hiring that had been rumored basically since, I don't know, Thanksgiving. And it is happening, it sounds like. Obviously, he has one more game to go. But, what they do defensively under Terrell Austin, we'll start with that, obviously, since Patricia is a defensive coach. They play a lot of zone on the back end under Austin. Do they are they a team that can make a drastic change and play that sort of smothering man defense that the Patriots have?
It'll come down in part to how they feel about Tease Tabor, their second round pick this year, who got better as the season progressed and was actually very good in December at times. They have a true number one in Darius Slay. In fact, Slay. Mm-hmm. He's in that very rare class that Malcolm Butler's in, where he can travel with smaller number one receivers. Most of these traveling guys are Xavier Rhodes, and they travel with the Julio Jones and the Alshon Jeffries of the world. There aren't a lot that travel with the Antonio Browns and the T.Y. Hiltons. Slay could be one of that. I think he could probably guard some of the bigger guys at times, too. So, yeah, I think there's a chance for that to occur. They also have versatility at safety because Quandre Diggs moved to safety due to injuries late in the season. I think they stumbled upon a new LaMarcus Joyner type, a really good flexible coverage safety. I like Detroit's personnel. It's not deep enough, and they have to figure out what they're going to do with Ziggy Ansah. He's a free agent, and he's a hard guy to figure a value for because he had 2 sacks 2 years ago and looked great on film, and then he had like 12 or 14, 13 or whatever it was this year and looked bad on film. And what do you pay him, and is he worth a franchise tag? There's a lot to sort out in Detroit. And then there's the whole other issue of who's coordinating the offense and what will that look like?
Yeah, and, I guess the short-term drama is going to be Jim Bob Cooter. Does he stay or does he go? We'll find out. We don't know at the moment. Would you move on?
Would I move on if I'm Jim Bob Cooter?
No, if you're Patricia, would you bring in your own guy? Or, I don't know, maybe they know each other. Maybe they're buddies now.
Maybe. I mean, coaches all kind of know coaches to some. It's the 7 degrees connection thing everywhere in the NFL. But I don't know the answer to that. That depends who I, if I'm Patricia, who I'd have in mind. You almost never fire a coach unless you know who you're replacing him with. And I don't know who Patricia would replace Jim Bob Cooter with. I think Bob Cooter as a coach is a good one because he's the one that's gotten the best out of Matthew Stafford. A lot of other coaches have tried. I think he's still a little bit of a work in progress. He's certainly an above average offensive coordinator. I think he can continue to get better, though. I think Detroit's offense can continue to get better under him, but Patricia might see it and say, hey, it should be better already, and I'm going to go with this guy, whoever this guy would be. I don't know.
Yeah, and in other offensive coordinator news, Dan Quinn confirmed Steve Sarkisian is staying on there as offensive coordinator, so we'll see what happens in year two. We talked about him a lot this year, so we'll just move on to topic number nine.
Number nine.
The AFC side of the coaching carousel. When we talked last week, it was all Mike Mularkey was staying, and we were delayed in our taping. And when we were starting to go, we thought Mularkey might be out. And then we were delayed, and then we taped in that like 12-hour window when Mularkey was getting an extension.
And you were mad. You were mad because you'd already written an article under the assumption that he was leaving, and your work was wasted.
Yeah, I had.
And then later, it's not wasted.
Then I had to update it, and then I had to update the update. But yeah, Mike Vrabel gets the Titans job, which I guess it's a little bit surprising because I think everyone assumed they were going to, you know, try and get the Sean McVay type to pair with Marcus Mariota. But, you know, Vrabel, big-time reputation. I mean, obviously he and I'm blanking on his name right now. John Robinson. He and John Robinson know each other from their Patriots days.
That's a Titans GM.
Yep, Titans GM. That's a good job, Andy. That's the kind of stuff I should do during this show. but Vrabel, leader of men type of reputation. And obviously, you know, everyone's down on they gave up so many points in Houston this year. Well, they were missing two All-Pro players. So yeah. That's kind of what happens when you lose two really good guys. Sometimes you give up points.
A couple things on that. One, selfishly, I'm disappointed because I'm down here in Mobile and Vrabel and I were getting together. I don't even know him. We were going to meet Tuesday night and watch film. It was his idea, too. And of course, I want to do that.
Yeah.
I know. And now I'm thinking he's probably not going to be here. And if he is, he's probably going to be meeting with more important people than me because he's got some positions to fill in his staff.
Yeah.
And I have taken my name out of the running. I already told him that. I'm not going to be on it, you know.
I was going to say, is he going to maybe peg you as offensive coordinator if that doesn't
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. But I think he wants someone that's going to play to Mariota's college style of play. And as you know, I'm more of the belief that pocket passing rules the day in the NFL. The other thing is, one thing that happens with head coaching hires, they sometimes take a few years. Vrabel may have won this job a year ago around the league in league circles, and the right landing spot didn't present itself until now. Look at Vance Joseph, for example. He got the Dolphins, he was the Dolphins defensive coordinator the year before he got the Broncos job. Those Dolphins ranked near the bottom of the league in a lot of categories. But he was such a highly sought-after coach as a position coach coming into that. Adam Gase knew he's probably losing Joseph after a year. And sure enough, he lost him even though the defense wasn't any good under Joseph because Joseph's reputation preceded him. Gase himself had the same thing happen. He was going to be a head coach. The job didn't present itself after he left Denver, so he landed in Chicago for a year. That offense was pretty average, but it was well coached. They just didn't have the personnel, and he still gets the job anyway. A lot of these jobs have a two-year delay on them because there's just so few of them, you can't always put the right candidate in the right spot. So I think they hired Vrabel based on his reputation last year more than on what they got this year.
All right. Well, another Patriots guy here, that's Josh McDaniels going to the Colts, so it'll be McDaniels pairing with Andrew Luck. To me, this wasn't just the best opening because of Andrew Luck. It's also the best opening because they went 4-12 this year, and I think expectations are a little more reasonable and in line. Like I was thinking, if you're Vrabel might get the same type of performance out of the Titans in 2018 as they had in 2017, and they might go 6-10 with all the injured talent coming back in that division.
Yeah. Yeah, they could, and I love the Luck and McDaniel pairing. I think it's perfect because I'm convinced. We spent a lot of this show talking about how valuable it is to extend plays in the pocket, like Nick Foles did that won the game tonight. And Luck's the best I've ever seen at that, at just that very specific trait. But even I have to admit, though, he's got to change the way he plays. He'll do that once in a while still. You can't take that completely out of a man, but he cannot rely on that the way he has throughout his career, because his shoulder's not going to survive if he does. You take too many hits when you play that way, typically. And if anyone can craft a system that still plays to Luck's strength while instilling discipline on him without going overboard, but making Luck responsible and letting him own the game still, but hey, you got to get the ball out quickly here, it's Josh McDaniel. That's what he's done for a number of years in New England. I think it's a great match because he'll give Luck the full gauntlet, but a lot of the gauntlet's going to be disciplined quarterbacking, quicker timing, ball's getting out, you're reading the defense before the snap, you're not going to run around within the pocket and read the defense only after the snapper, or make the incredible play is no longer your foundation, as good as you were at it.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, as far as that roster goes, they are rebuilding it at the moment, so McDaniels might have a year to figure things out. Coordinator news over there, kind of a surprise move locally here as far as I'm concerned. John Morton out for the Jets. That surprised some people. There were a bunch of weird whispers and explanations that went out there, maybe some personality conflicts. But yeah, he's out after what was an overachieving offense this year.
Yeah, it's got to be something weird that went on, because the Jets were very well coached this season schematically on offense. That was a really well schemed offense, and Josh McCown was a very good quarterback. He was a very solid professional quarterback this year, and he's probably not going to be their QB next year. But Morton did a good job with a placeholder QB with no talent around that placeholder QB, or very limited talent anyway.
Yeah, and last one here. I don't have any specific firsthand knowledge on this person's personality here, but Todd Haley is out in Pittsburgh, and he just seems to be a guy that he seems to be like a walking personality conflict. It seems like just nobody gets along with him. So he is out there. Randy Fincher, the quarterback's coach, gets promoted. So you figure they'll have some continuity there. But, you know, Haley went in there with the job of basically turning Ben Roethlisberger into a guy who, I don't know, could play into his mid and late 30s instead of having every bone of his body broken by age 31 or so. And he did that. And obviously, they're still really good offensively. It's just when you step back, if you didn't know any of the sort of behind-the-scenes stories about it and all the whispers about Haley, you'd be kind of like, wow, he seemed to do a really good job there. And you know, now it's done.
We just talked about how you needed to instill discipline upon Andrew Luck with the scheme and force him to get the ball out quickly. That's exactly what Haley did with Roethlisberger. And most likely, Haley is a different personalities. Let's call it that. I don't know Todd Haley either. I had a drink at the bar with him at the Combine last year. I went in with Greg Olson, who was the Rams QB coach at the time, is now the Raiders offensive coordinator. Todd Haley bought Greg Olson a drink. Greg said, hey, I'm with Andy, so Todd bought Andy a drink. And then Greg got washed away in the crowd. It was just me and Todd Haley, who did not know each other at all, drinking the beer together. And I had to make conversation. And I will tell you about the conversation sometime, Gary. He's an interesting guy. So that's all I know about him. But, it's different personalities. And it was time to move on. I think Roethlisberger, at this point, he's had so much success the last few years under what Haley was doing. I think he can self-regulate now. And I think he'll play the game the way he has the last few years. He needed Haley to give him the push, but now he can fly without Todd Haley. And he'll be just fine. And they win a lot of one-on-one stuff there in Pittsburgh. It's not an overly complex scheme. They don't do stuff that other people can't figure out. They just have Antonio Brown, Martavis Bryant, and Le'Veon Bell. They've got three guys, two of whom are Hall of Fame level, that you cannot guard one-on-one, and they create one-on-one scenarios for them.
Number 10.
Topic 10, Andy. The weekly awards.
Yeah. I'm back to not liking these. Last week we needed to fill it in. We needed a topic. This week we have lots of topics. We could have split up the coordinators and head coaches and made that separate topics, and then we don't have to do this ridiculous everybody gets a trophy thing.
Well, it's very important to hand out these trophies. It's some of the biggest honors these guys will get this year. Offensive player of the week.
Tom Brady. I'm going to mail it in. Tom Brady.
All right. I'll give it to Nick Foles, who was probably the, just played the game of his life.
I'll give it to Danny Amendola, because nobody ever pays any attention to how great he is, and they would not have won this game without the catches he made. And that was true in the Super Bowl, by the way, against Atlanta. Nobody remembers that either. He had three enormous third down catches in that game that they don't win if he doesn't have those. And I asked him in training camp, does anybody ever say anything to you about those? And he said no. And I said, well, what do you like your friends and family? Like, you're not winning the Super Bowl without those catches. And he kind of said, yeah, I know. But no one ever, even his friends and family, they don't talk about that a whole lot.
Like, did you play in the Super Bowl? Are you still in the NFL?
Were you out there? Yeah, it's just who you're dating this week, Danny. And he's always got a great answer to that, too.
He does. Defensive player of the week, who do you got?
You go first. I have to think.
I don't have a great sense of what he did game long, but I'll give it to Stephon Gilmore, who made a couple of really nice plays, and obviously he made the game clinching play on the diving deflection there.
Yeah, that's who I was gonna go with. Fletcher Cox okay. Showed up throughout the game. Is that fine? That's good enough? Okay.
He did. That was true. He wore his uniform and everything. Yeah. I think I gave it to Fletcher Cox last. Fletcher Cox could probably win this award pretty much every week. Special teams player of the week. Who are you giving it to, Andy?
Oh, boy. I mean, this one's really getting pulled out from behind me now. I mean, I don't know. I fast-forwarded through the special teams plays still today, too. I had a deadline to get writing this article afterwards.
Why don't you give it to Josh Lambeau for hitting a 54-yarder? It's a long
Who's
field
that?
Goal.
No, I'm kidding. Jaguars I know who kicker. That is. That's Jax. I know, Jax. All right, I'll give it to Josh Lambeau for nailing a 54-yard field goal, and then he also did have like a 43-yarder that was right down the middle, if I recall.
I'm going to give it to – I'm going to make 10 things podcast history right here. I'm going to give special team player of the week to Danny Amendola. So he gets two gift cards.
What did he do on special teams? Is he the return
he
guy?
Had that at, no, he had a big 20-yard return.
The return guy.
After his first touchdown.
Right,
Patriots
it was late.
Still
yeah,
down.
Yeah,
20-yard return.
Field position. It was a big field position swing.
I don't know exactly what the if this was an actual strategy or is this is something that just happens. And I think Nance even mentioned on the podcast, mm-hmm. on the broadcast, is Amendola like faked the poison call. Like he was waving his arms frantically and then he just caught the ball and ran it 20 yards.
Yeah, you see that every once in a while. And as long as you keep your arms down, you're not given any – you can't come close to putting your arms near the top of your body because that's faking a fair catch and that's not allowed. Mm-hmm. But it worked out in that case. That was a big moment in the game. That gave New England the ball almost at, I think, in field goal range in the fourth quarter of a close game.
That was really big. And as we know from Jenny Vrentis's tremendous story, left-footed punters got to have a lefty in Gillette Stadium. That is a stadium made for lefties. Punting-wise.
Yep. Coach of the week?
Coach of the week. Do you want to go first?
No, you go ahead.
Well, I'll give it to Josh McDaniels for rolling out the, they had that double pass, which was such a weirdly slow developing play where just Cameron Fleming did like a somersault at one point, and it just seemed to take forever for the ball to both passes. Like it took forever to get the first pass out, and then everyone sort of stopped, and then it took forever for the other pass to get across the field, and it was cool. And then they had the flea flicker. A lot of flea flickers today.
Brady went to his second read on the flea flicker. I don't think I've ever seen a quarterback go to the second read on a flea flicker. I mean, he had time to go warm up a cup of coffee during the duration of that play. To get to your second read on that is late. Dorsett's route doesn't even begin for 4 seconds into the play because he's got to act like he's jogging to run block at first.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I think we had three flea flickers today. It's late in the show. I can't even talk anymore. Three flea flickers today. Had the long touchdown to Alshon to Torrey Smith in Philadelphia, and that one, and the Jaguars ran one that ended up Bortles started to take off a little bit, and then he ended up throwing a little pass to I think it was Allen Hurns on the run.
A lot of flea flickers. Someone needs to open the game with one sometime.
Someone must
get a safety out there who's all jazzed up, ready to play. Run the ball right at the middle and pitch it and go deep over that safety. You'd be a single high safety to start the game. Almost no one starts in cover two very often.
Yeah. Do you have it? Where are we, coach?
No, we did. Am I supposed to?
Can I do
McDaniels,
right?
As well? Because I already talked about the flea flicker. I'll go McDaniels. Can I do McDaniels?
Sure.
That's what I'm doing.
All right. That's a show. We got to do better on those. It's tough to do when there's only two games.
Yeah, it's not my total lack of preparation and overwhelming apathy about the whole thing. It's the lack of games. You're right. It's two
there
games. It's not enough. It's not enough to have good awards.
Now listen, everyone, the Mailbag Show is coming up. The Mailbag Special Show coming up Friday. We're going to do at least one. We're going to do, I don't know, maybe more of them if it goes well. And that will also have the special road trip. A lot of special stuff in that. Special road trip correspondence coming from the rest of the MMQB crew. Should be really good. We'd like to know how you feel about it. But as for now, that's a wrap. Thanks, as always, to Lou Pellegrino back in the saddle tonight for us. Shelby Royston is out. He was deactivated before this one. He's out with an injury. So get well soon. And Shelby should be back next week. So we'll all be happy about that. Editor Chris Basil, all the guys at Cadence 13, we appreciate them. We love them. And we're glad they do this with us. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening. Like we keep saying, send those questions for the mailbag. Super Bowl questions are great. If you have something else, we'll look at it. But, less likely it'll get answered. Andy_Benoit, GGremling_SI on Twitter. TalkBack@TheMMQB.com, or we are both on Facebook. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB Podcast with Peter King, and this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things Podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys with a Super Bowl deep dive next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.